You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us to what I'm sure will be an incredibly lively conversation. My name is Ann Beeson, and I'm the Director of U.S. Programs here at the Open Society Institute. And I'm delighted to kind of give a very brief introduction, say a few words this morning to get us started, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jamil Dakwar, who's going to facilitate the conversation. We're particularly delighted to be hosting this conversation because OSI is proud to have helped to support some of the work that you're going to hear discussed tonight. I'm not going to give the fuller introductions of our very esteemed speakers because Jamil will do that, but I did want to say that we were very glad to have been able to support the report, the fantastic report that Laurel Fletcher and Eric Stover wrote about Guantanamo and its aftermath, and we were also delighted to be able to support Jonathan Mahler as a Soros Justice Fellow as he did some of the research and writing in preparation for his terrific book, The Challenge, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. OSI has been supporting work to stem the backlash against civil liberties and human rights in the name of national security since 9/11. We ramped up that support somewhat significantly about a year ago by launching a new campaign, a new national security and human rights campaign in close partnership with our friends over at Atlantic Philanthropies. And we spent the first year trying to provide additional support to a range of groups and great thinkers who were preparing for this moment that we now have, the opportunity to really turn back the clock and to restore policies, national security policies that are respectful of the rule of law and respectful of human rights. And we are, we all know, panel is titled Obama's Dilemma, that in fact, President-elect Obama will have a number of challenges facing him. We know that. And one of them, of course, is what to do once he closes Guantanamo, which we are delighted that he is committed to doing. There are a range of additional challenges. We want to make sure that the solution to those dilemmas are progressive solutions, again, that support human rights. And so with that, I want to just very briefly, it's my very personal pleasure to introduce Jamil Dakwar, who is currently the director of the Human Rights Program at the American Civil Liberties Union. He succeeded me in that position, and I was so delighted to be able to leave an incredibly accomplished human rights advocate in that role. He is a human rights advocate with many years of experience before the ACLU, was at Human Rights Watch doing research and human rights advocacy and documentation on torture around the world and many other important issues. And before that was an accomplished advocate with Adala, a fantastic organization based in Israel advocating for Palestinian rights and the human rights of many people there. So, Jamil, I want to just turn it over to you, and I'll move out of your seat, and thank you all again for joining us.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us. One of the things that we're good to have is the weather got a little bit better for people in New York, and just coming from Iowa City, where temperatures don't go higher than 15 or 20, it was good to be back here in New York. I'm very honored to be here, and thank you, Anne, for this kind introduction. You know, we owe Anne a lot, the ACLU, of pushing the organizations taking on the human rights framework, and I think this is a very timely event. And before I introduce the speakers tonight, not only because we are in a transition moment to a new administration, a new president is going to take office in the White House, and we'll be talking about that a lot this evening, but it's also, there are two anniversaries, very important anniversaries. Actually, today is the 60th anniversary of the adoption of the Genocide Convention. That was the immediate result of lessons learned from the World War II and the aftermath of the Holocaust and what happened then. The second anniversary, maybe a little bit more hopeful than the Genocide Convention, is the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That was also adopted on December 10th by the General Assembly, and with great influence and leadership from the United States, headed by former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. I think this is particularly right moment to mention those two anniversaries, because I think the U.S. in particular in the past 7-8 years lost a lot of credibility, and particularly in its in this political and moral standing in the world. And I think that we will be discussing ways to move forward and how the U.S. can claim its leadership in the world. First, I want to introduce the speakers, starting from my right, the very right, Laurel Fletcher, a professor, and as you heard earlier, she's one of the authors of the report that will be discussed tonight. She has expertise in designing and implementing an interdisciplinary problem-based approach to human rights research, advocacy, and policy. She works in international criminal and humanitarian law, as well as globalization and migration. She has conducted field work on grave human rights violations in countries including Bosnia, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and the United States. Professor Fletcher has extensive experience interviewing survivors of gross human rights violations as legal counsel, investigator, and researcher. Another speaker tonight, Professor Eric Stover, who has extensive research experience and experience conducting field work with victims of gross human rights violations in over a dozen countries, including former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. During the wars in Croatia and Bosnia, he led several medical-legal investigations of mass graves as an expert on mission to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. He also conducted a survey of mass graves throughout Rwanda for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda in 1995. He's the author of an award-winning book, The Witnesses, War Crimes and the Promise of Justice in The Hague, from Pennsylvania University Press, 2005. Since 2006, he has investigated the relationship between human rights violations and the spread of infectious disease in Burma and its border regions. And the last speaker tonight with us, Jonathan Miller. Jonathan is the author of the critically acclaimed The Challenge, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, and The Fight Over Presidential Power, a book that was published earlier this year in August. He is also the author of the best-selling book, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, a 2004 New York Times notable book. He is the contributing writer to the New York Times and has written for many other publications, including the New Republic, the New York Times Book Review, and the New York Magazine. We're very happy to have the three of you. We're going to start, and the way we're going to do it tonight is we're going to have a little time for introductory remarks and then providing a little background on both what happened since 9/11 leading up to some of the very most recent developments, both on the legal and political front. And then we will be having the chance to take questions from you. We will have, unfortunately, to evacuate and basically leave this place by 7:45 so that people who will take care of reorganizing the space can do that before it's too late for them. So we hopefully can do it, and it will be particularly important. So one of the main reasons that I think a lot of people have looked at back in the last 7-8 years and have noticed what went wrong and why we got to the level where the U.S. have, over the past 7-8 years, became moved from a government that championed anti-torture, was in support of advocates against indefinite detention, against military commissions and emergency courts overseas, against many other human rights violations that occurred overseas, to a country where you have a president that had asked and claimed that he has the inherent authority as a chief commander or commander-in-chief to put forward policies and practices that are permissible in a wartime. So we would like to a little bit investigate those premises and see whether really national security trumps human rights and on what grounds that can happen or could not happen. While doing that, I think we want to very much start with the really major problem of this particular era between 2001 and very recently, is that claiming that the fight against terrorism is a war. This paradigm of moving from criminal justice situation where based on the conflict itself, whether there's an international armed conflict or a non-international armed conflict, or if it's an internal strife and other kinds of situations that were dealt by the international community, both international organizations, governments, using international criminal law, human rights law, and international humanitarian law, moving to an administration that claimed this is a new kind of war, a war that, as I mentioned earlier, the president has the unchecked authority to establish certain regime where people can be held in indefinite detention, can be declared unlawful enemy combatants, can be tortured and abused without no checks from the judiciary or very limited checks from other bodies of government. So I want to move to Jonathan to kind of a little bit lay out some of the things that he did in his book, looking at the case of Hamdan as a tremendous case, started from a guy who was shipped to Guantanamo and held there and became really the icon of the struggle against the so-called war on terror, at least in the legal front.
That's right. Well, thank you for having me. It was it's a privilege to be here. And you know, without the support of OSI, I would probably not have been able to write this book. So it's really fortunate for me. My book really tells the story of the Guantanamo detainee Salem Hamdan, who was a driver for Osama bin Laden, and it tells the story of him and his two lawyers, one of whom was a Navy JAG lawyer, a Navy officer, and one of whom was a young law professor at Georgetown. And essentially, what I try to do in the book is you know, sort of unfold the story of both Hamdan and his background. He came from a poor tribal region in Yemen with about the equivalent of a fourth grade education, was recruited for jihad outside a mosque in Yemen one day when he was in his early 20s, and eventually sort of found his way to bin Laden and was never really rose above the level of driver and mechanic, but nevertheless was picked up after 9/11. In November 2001, was actually picked up as he was bringing his wife and young daughter, and his wife was actually 8 months pregnant at the time. He was bringing them to the border in Pakistan, left them at the border, and turned back around and was captured and taken into custody, turned over to American forces, and was kept in U.S. prisons in Afghanistan for about 6 months, and then was sent in May of 2002 to Guantanamo, and that's where he sat for largely in solitary confinement for a couple of years. When into his cell one day walks a man in a Navy uniform saying, "I'm your government-appointed lawyer. I'm here to represent you." And needless to say, Hamdan had been interrogated dozens of times by men who looked exactly like this man. So he didn't have much reason to believe that this man, Lieutenant Commander Charlie Swift, was indeed there to help him. That was Swift's first struggle, really, and it was an ongoing struggle that continued really through Hamdan's release just a couple of weeks ago, that to prove to him that he really was there to help him. And he was, and you know, the assumption at the time, this was back in 2004, was that Swift wasn't really going to, that he was a government-appointed lawyer, that he wasn't going to really put up much of a defense for this guy, that he was basically a military guy who was going to do what the military wanted him to do, but instead he intended to not only defend Hamdan on the facts of the case, and which is to say he was going to say that he was really just a driver, that he doesn't deserve to be tried, certainly doesn't deserve to be convicted of anything serious. But he was going to do more than that. He was going to actually challenge the whole legal system in which Hamdan was to be tried. And that legal system was this system of military commissions that President Bush created. It was very much a product of what Jamil was talking about, this war idea of a war paradigm and the administration's plan after 9/11 to treat terrorism not as a criminal action, not as a crime, but as a war. And that in the administration's belief gave the president really pretty much unfettered power to do whatever he wanted in the name of the prosecution of the war on terror. And one of the things, so just, you know, to give you a couple other examples, I mean, that meant that he could really, in his mind, violate the laws and the laws of the United States and treaties that were parties to. So it enabled the creation of the secret surveillance program, the warrantless wiretapping. It enabled the creation of these ghost prisons in foreign countries where we would send detainees to be tortured for intelligence. And it also enabled the creation of this system of military tribunals, which the president authorized unilaterally in the aftermath of 9/11, though it is, of course, Congress that is charged with passing the laws in this country. The president said that my administration, my Pentagon is going to create this system of trials. We're going to decide who is to be tried, how these trials will work, what the charges will be, and there will be no appeals, there will be no access to the federal court system at all. No challenges can be brought to the system in the federal court system. So that is the system that this lawyer, Lieutenant Commander Charlie Swift, and a law professor, a constitutional law professor, who he brought in to help him out, that's the system that they challenged in a case that after 2 years, really, of hard work and lots of kind of internal struggles, made it to the Supreme Court and resulted in a historic decision that I write about in the book, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. But it's very much a product, these military commissions are very much a product, and just one element of this broader strategy, this broader idea that in a time of war, the president can do really whatever he wants. Unfortunately, that was the administration's kind of ongoing understanding for years. And so an entire legal structure has been created under that assumption. This is, in this case at least, the Supreme Court ruled in Hamdan's favor, and sort of turned. It was a very, very sort of powerful rebuke to the administration. The Supreme Court said, actually, in times of war, the president is obligated to observe the laws and treaties of the United States, and these military tribunals are unlawful. That if you want to do this, you need Congress's buy-in. You need to do this with Congress. But it's really just one example of this larger system, this larger problem that we're discussing here tonight. And obviously, Guantanamo was a sort of central facet of this, because the Guantanamo again was created sort of unilaterally in the aftermath of 9/11, and it was created essentially as an indefinite kind of holding facility, and only when pushed by the Supreme Court did the Bush administration acknowledge that it needed to start providing some sort of due process on Guantanamo and started giving detainees any kind of hearing. As it turned out, the hearings were largely inadequate, and it was the administration's kind of refusal to see Guantanamo as to see the war on terror as not a conventional war where you can hold prisoners until the end of hostilities, when the hostilities may be going on for generations, that kind of led to the problem, I think, that we're trying to figure out how to address now.
So before we move to hear a little bit more about the extensive research that was done by distinguished professors here. I want to just mention that it took a while until the detainees at Guantanamo got access to lawyers and to some access to courts, and at least filing their papers.
That's right. And in fact, I just should mention that when Commander Lieutenant Commander Swift was first assigned to Hamdan, he was assigned by the government. He was told by the government that he could meet with his client for the purpose of negotiating a guilty plea. So the government's assumption was and expectation was that Swift was just going to go down there and get this guy to plead guilty. He wasn't even told what the charges were going to be. But he still had to go down there and in his very first meeting with Hamdan say, the government wants you to plead guilty. And literally Hamdan said, to what? And Swift said, well, we don't know yet, but even this man with a fourth grade education and no understanding of the American legal system at that moment kind of understood, something's kind of off here. So that's right, and it was only through force of will and persistence and ultimately a Supreme Court ruling that lawyers were enabled to have kind of ongoing access to these guys.
So between 2004 and 2008, we had three major Supreme Court decisions that came down as a result of a legal challenge, and there's a lot of reporting by human rights groups and advocacy going on. But what is interesting is that you have the court every time since 2004, in the first case, in the Rasul case, telling the government you ought to provide some kind of due process for the Guantanamo detainees. And so the government set those bizarre tribunals, the CSRT, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, to review each individual detainee and determine whether they fit the presidential definition of unlawful enemy combatant. And then yet the government went to Congress and got the Detainee Treatment Act to bypass the Supreme Court ruling, getting detainees access. In the meantime, Hamdan case made its way all the way to the Supreme Court, and we got another decision in 2006, in this time in June 2006, and yet another time after the Supreme Court instructions, the government went to the Congress and just before the midterm elections passed the Military Commission Act that kind of reestablished almost the same system of military commissions but also did other things, including closing those loopholes that did allow some of the detainees to have their day in court in filing some habeas corpus cases. And yet another case made its way all the way to the Supreme Court, and in 2008, just last June, the Supreme Court, in the case of Boumediene, had ruled again in favor of the detainees and said detainees do have right to file habeas corpus. The U.S. Constitution does apply in Guantanamo, but it was very specific to habeas cases challenging the legality of detention.
That's right. I just want to make one last point on that, if you don't mind. That I think it's. I mean, just to. It's important to note just how historically significant it is that the Supreme Court, which really never likes to go against the president during a time of war. I mean, that's something that that these unelected representatives, who are appointed for life, don't want to tell the president what he needs to do to keep the country safe. It's happened over and over again during the Bush administration, which was really historically remarkable. So,
the first interview that Professor Fletcher and Professor Stover did was in May 2006. And the last interview for that extensive research and report was in June 2008. So there was two major legal development in the middle, and we'll be very interested to hear from you a little bit more about the research, about the report. How did you start that, and the stages starting from Afghanistan, tracking the detainees to Guantanamo, and finding what happened to those individuals?
I'll begin. Thanks, Jamil. And then Laurel will take over. We do a kind of dog and pony show, and you can decide who's the dog and the pony. But since we released the report 2 weeks ago, we've been speaking quite a bit about the findings. Let me first mention, so the first question is, why did we do this report? And secondly, why are we releasing it now? Why we decided to undertake this study was because many of the lawyers that have been alluded to here who have had clients in Guantanamo were actually going, once they were released, would actually go to their home countries or third countries and meet their families, and were starting to report back that they were having difficulties integrating into their communities. And there have been a number of very good reports, Human Rights Watch, Physicians for Human Rights, Human Rights First, who have looked at aspects of Guantanamo, but we had found that nobody had really looked at the plight of former detainees. What did it mean from the point of being apprehended in Pakistan or Afghanistan, and then to being to going through Guantanamo, being released, and particularly being reintegrated back into their communities? I'd like to acknowledge and actually just point out to you, pick up a copy of this before you leave. I don't think you can take Jonathan's book, but this is a handout by Patty Blum, who was instrumental in helping us. It's on pardons. And the International Center for Transitional Justice is doing a very good job of looking at what are the potential for pardons and how we should think about this historically and in policy making. So the second question is, why now? Well, we decided to wait until after the election because we wanted to fast forward and look at what the new administration could and should do in order to deal with these problems. So quickly, our study was we interviewed 62 former detainees in 9 countries. These were anonymous interviews because we wanted the detainees to be able to speak freely, particularly about their governments and what had happened to them since they'd returned. And you know, that's difficult if we were to name them. We also interviewed about 50 former on-base personnel. These include interrogators, medical personnel, psychologists, and interrogators and interpreters. We also interviewed a number of high-level U.S. policymakers. And 18 lawyers who had clients in Guantanamo, former or currently. And what we wanted to do was to, unlike other reports, we wanted to understand with a semi-structured questionnaire, we tape record the interviews and then we analyze the data, what were patterns that we were seeing from these detainees? So what was this process? What did it mean to them? And quickly in our findings, in Afghanistan, we found that most of these detainees were either picked up in Pakistan or Afghanistan. And they spent an average of about 3 years in Guantanamo. We found that a third of those we spoke with had been picked up by bounties. And bounties were distributed after the war broke out in early October of 2001. Secretary Rumsfeld said they will fall like snowflakes, and indeed they did. These bounties were leaflets that went down. And people were picked up and turned in to the Pakistani authorities or to the Americans. And as a result of that, you found a stream of thousands of prisoners going into Kandahar and Bagram into U.S. custody. Meanwhile, from Washington, D.C., you were starting to get pressure to start sending detainees to Guantanamo. And as a result of this, our first finding was that this was really a flawed policy, which created this movement of detainees into Guantanamo, which were not a real security threat to the United States. In fact, Major Dunleavy, who was the first commander at Guantanamo, went to Afghanistan at the end of 2002, and he said, "You know, why are you sending me so many Mickey Mouse prisoners? You know, we need detainees." Other government officials have said a third to a half of detainees should never have been sent to Guantanamo in the first place. In terms of abuse, other organizations have found the same thing, but in particular we found at Bagram was the use of shackling above the head to a wire that would usually be held in a cage before and after interrogation, sometimes hours on end. Repeatedly, you'd be let down, you'd be put up again. There were beatings took place, what's called force drift in psychology. Once you get one guard doing this and another guard doing it, if there's no clear direction from the top or discipline, then this carries on. We also found that forced nudity was a problem. And that may be surprising, but in Islam, the taboo of being nude in front of others is just not acceptable and wrong. and also the extent that we found that the International Committee of the Red Cross, when they made visits to the prisons, they were often detainees were taken away during those visits. Transferred to Guantanamo. In Guantanamo, our message is don't think of Guantanamo only as a detention center. It is an interrogation center. And once you start to understand that that was the purpose of Guantanamo, you come to understand the effects on the former detainees. As an interrogation center, the system that was put in place was one in which guards would collaborate with interrogators. At least in the early years, we know medical files, interrogators had access to medical files. We know psychologists eventually arrived and psychiatrists who would help work with interrogators to design ways of breaking down the resistance of detainees. And so in this atmosphere, and it's happened before, we can question and answer, we can go into it, but is a process of dependency in which you find detainees are becoming more and more dependent on their interrogators simply to exist, to have some kind of human contact. What we found, and also many in the American Medical Association, Psychological Association, all passed resolutions prohibiting their personnel or their members from participating or designing interrogation methods at Guantanamo. Of those that we interviewed who said they characterized their interrogations as abusive, they mentioned solitary confinement. Those that we interviewed was up to 30 days. You could go back and forth from solitary confinement. 18 of the 18 attorneys that we interviewed, 12 of them told us that the greatest mental deterioration they saw was because of solitary confinement. Medically, we know the effects of solitary confinement. 9 of those, emphasized that this had taken a real effect on their clients. And we've seen even today in some of the headlines today, we know what that effect can be. Also, exposure to extreme cold, short shackling, stress positions, sexual humiliation, and simultaneous sensory deprivation, being blasted with loud music and strobe lights. Then you might be taken off into interrogation or isolation, brought back, and so on. We conclude in our study that while it's important to look at individual acts of torture and cruelty, such as waterboarding, no question is torture, it's also important to understand the cumulative effect that happens to these men over time. And that's one in which it's simultaneous. They are desperate. They don't know. They don't know when they're going to be released. There were even occasions when they learned that somebody from their embassy was coming to visit them at Guantanamo, and it turned out to be an intelligence officer who was there to interrogate them. And that this cumulative effect is clearly, in our view, cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment as defined by international and domestic law, and also in many cases rises to the level of torture. And from there, I'll turn it over to Laurel, who will then talk about the return of detainees.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for coming out tonight. It's really gratifying to see so much interest in this issue, and particularly at this time, and I look forward to the discussion where we can talk about some of these challenges for President-elect Obama. I want to begin and just remind people of some statistics that some of you may be familiar with, but I think bear repeating in this context, and that of the known population of Guantanamo is about 780, and of those, 520 have been released, so that's over 65%. There's a great deal of attention now in the press, given President-elect Obama's pledge to close Guantanamo, about the 250 that remained. But our study was looking at a glimpse. You know, we had less than a fifth of those who had been released, but to try and understand what that experience has meant to those who were subjected to it. And that's really the contribution of our research. Now, to begin with, the policy of the U.S. government is not to, quote, release detainees, even though we'll talk about that. I might slip and use that vocabulary. Technically, detainees are transferred off of the base into the custody of another government, and they're transferred with conditions. And the conditions can include transfer for the purpose of domestic prosecution, transfer for further detention, or transfer for release.
detainees themselves have no idea which category they fall into and what conditions, in fact, may have been negotiated about their release. And so Jamil talked about the CSRT process, which was an individual process of review by military officials about whether or not they fell into the category of enemy combatant or not. But that process and its outcome largely has nothing to do with ultimate transfer. Transfers are negotiated by the U.S. government and foreign governments. And you can be cleared for transfer, meaning through that process, and still stuck in Guantanamo. And I think some of you may know about that, so-called Guantanamo refugees. You may be transferred home and never having been cleared by that CSRT process. So it's just important to sort of recognize from the outset that the legal processes that Jonathan's talking about and Jamil will talk about on the ground for those who are in Guantanamo bear little relationship to their treatment. The government has said that those who are transferred for further detention generally are released. And there have been reports, documentation about subsequent persecution of released detainees. However, we found in the 62 former detainees who we interviewed that 45 of those, in fact, were released within 72 hours of being returned home. And so in the main, what we're looking at in our study are the challenges that were faced by detainees when they were quickly released and from captivity and returned home or to a third country to civilian life. And what were the challenges that we found? First and foremost is what we call the Guantanamo stigma. Remember, none of those 520 were ever convicted of a crime. Neither were they exonerated of wrongdoing, or were they acknowledged that they were falsely detained. So without that, when they return to their communities, the association is, you were in Guantanamo. Guantanamo is where terrorists are kept, or dangerous people. Therefore, you are a dangerous person. And that stigma resulted in difficulty reintegrating in communities and oftentimes rejection from their own families. So we saw divorces or separations. The primary material effect that we saw was difficulty obtaining or regaining employment. Only 6 of the 62 former detainees we spoke with had permanent employment. And we were talking with people who had been released as soon as recently as 7 months before their interview with us, and as long as 3 years. And we couldn't find any discernible pattern in treatment and how they were faring. Now, it may be that this is too short a time period to study, but certainly the data indicate that during this, what can be as long as three and a half years, that there are real significant challenges that release detainees face, and that stigma being first and foremost. Families went into debt when their head of household was in detention. The head of household returns from Guantanamo, unable to repay that debt or reestablish their, if they were a shop owner, they can't reestablish their inventory. If they were a taxi driver, they can't afford to buy a new taxi. And that, in addition to the debt that their families took on, made it incredibly difficult for them just to move on, to get on with their lives. They also, several talked about, I can't afford the medications that were prescribed to me in Guantanamo for a mental illness that I developed as a result of my detention. So that was quite poignant. There were fully two-thirds of the detainees we spoke to self-reported psychological problems that they attribute to the fact that they were held in Guantanamo. These were symptoms that they developed in Guantanamo. Some were treated there, some were not, and they've returned home. So what do these look like? Flashbacks, nightmares, outbursts of anger, a feeling that I'm not myself, withdrawal from family, from loved ones, a host of problems. And they describe that their lives, that Guantanamo isn't over for them, that it's still casting a shadow over their lives, and they haven't really been able to move on. We also asked former detainees about their attitudes towards their own government, towards the U.S. government, and there I think the findings were somewhat surprising. Well, what isn't surprising is we asked them what their opinion of the United States was since their detention, and unsurprisingly, they held a negative opinion. They were angry. They were frustrated. But what was interesting is that they were very clear to differentiate between the U.S. government and the American people. And they said that their frustration and their disappointment and their anger was directed at the U.S. government, and that they didn't, and they wanted to tell us, I don't hold the U.S. people responsible. And some of them actually wanted to take the opportunity, as they were speaking to us, to say, I want to let you know that I want to thank those American citizens who stood up and advocated for my release that they only found out about after I had been returned home. Now, they did want justice, not vengeance. And justice for them meant primarily the opportunity to resume their lives. So compensation of their homes, if their homes had been destroyed, the ability to get their job back, to restart their lives. Less important for them was accountability, which I think is something we're going to get into in the discussion. Several of them did mention, yes, I think that that the political leaders of the United States government should be held accountable for what they did. But for many, many if not most, that was not the most important priority. The most important priority for them was, I just want to get on with my life. And I could even understand how the U.S. government could have been confused about this situation, and they didn't have the information. And as Eric mentioned, often, you know, when my government, who knows my story, who knows that, who should have been able to help me, instead they sent military intelligence to interrogate me. They were more disappointed, I would say, in their home government on that account. So that we asked them, and those who are still in Guantanamo, they said quite simply, if they've committed a crime, try them. And if they haven't, then they should be released. So that's, I think, a typical opinion that may be shared by many in the room. As a result of our findings, we are calling for the creation of an independent, nonpartisan commission of inquiry that would examine all aspects of the detention and interrogation system set up not just for Guantanamo, but Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11. And in order to simply closing Guantanamo is not going to erase the stain, both against the U.S. reputation abroad or address the harm for the lives of those individuals who've been subjected to this system of interrogation and detention. And in order to be effective, this commission needs to be composed of independent experts drawn from law, public health, medical personnel, former military members with intelligence background, and should be divided into working groups so there can be a working group that asks the questions, why were so many people who had no business being sent to Guantanamo? What went wrong? What went wrong with the interrogation policies? And also important, what or who did the right thing? Because I don't think that we would know as much as we do, as partial as that knowledge is, we wouldn't know as much as we know today were it not for courageous individuals who leaked information, who tried to do the right thing and spread the word. It may not be enough in the end, but I think it's important and they should be acknowledged as well. Finally, a commission should have subpoena power to get access to the documents and testimony that it needs to do its job, and should have the power to recommend criminal investigations so that we don't see this as a commission instead of prosecutions, but these can work in tandem and ought to work in tandem so that we, as the American public, get a full accounting of what went wrong and recommendations for how to correct those past mistakes. So I'm going to conclude there and hope we can.
Well, I think this is a good segue, Laura, to the issue of how do we move from here in terms of the Obama administration and obviously this is not only up to the president. There's a lot of things that the president can do on day one as the executive head of the executive branch and issuing and signing on executive orders, for example, of shutting the facility itself. There were some reports recently saying that, you know, he needs act of Congress to do that. And in fact, he does not. He does have the power to sign an executive order, not only to close Guantanamo, but also to close the to end the rendition program that we didn't have time to discuss, but is part of the practices that the Bush administration adopted after 9/11. What is interesting, and I want to give Jonathan a chance to talk about how does he see the future of the military commission system under the Obama administration? One thing I want to just mention is that the last detainee that was transferred to Guantanamo, other than the CIA held detainees, was in September 2004. The president revealed the CIA secret detention program in the summer of 2006, and in addition to the hundreds of men that were held indefinitely there, he added the former CIA detainees, what are known to be the high-value detainees, including the accused of planning and executing the attacks on 9/11. But the reason I'm mentioning this is because in addition to Guantanamo, you have other operations going on. You have in Afghanistan, Bagram is still in place. There's no access. Lawyers don't have much access to Guantanamo. Iraq is still a large theater of war where you have a large-scale detention operations. In fact, the highest number of detainees are held in Iraq and not in Guantanamo or in Afghanistan. And in addition, you have still the CIA left with the authority to use what is called enhanced interrogation techniques that basically are torture and abusive methods, even after an attempt by Congress to outlaw those abusive interrogation. In fact, the president vetoed an amendment that was aimed at making all the armed services, including the CIA, follow the Army Field Manual that was revised after the scandal in Abu Ghraib and clearly now establish prohibitions such as the prohibition on not to use waterboarding. That's explicit in the Army Field Manual. And yet the CIA still enjoys kind of not only the freedom to use those methods, abusive methods, but also immunity under the Military Commission Act. So I want to move quickly to Jonathan. Before we open up to questions, in terms of what do you think will be the future of military commissions, especially that detention operations continuing in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, the first of all, I mean, just in terms of context, I mean, these military commissions have now, as Jamil and I suggested earlier, they've been twice knocked down by the Supreme Court, first in the Hamdan decision and then in the Boumediene decision. So they really didn't even begin until this past summer. The first trial took place. It was Hamdan's trial, and this was almost 7 years after these trials were first authorized. And the very idea, the very reason for doing these trials was that there's a history of military tribunals in this country, but they're courts of necessity. You have military tribunals when you need a battlefield court to dispense justice quickly in the midst of a war, and you don't have time to do it any other way. That's historically we've done them in situations where there was martial law or in occupied territories. The way that we have never done military tribunals before was to create an entirely new trial system years after and bring people to trial years after after they were first taken into custody. So the very process by which this all happens suggests that there's no reason to do this. I mean, the reason to do them is they're courts of necessity. Well, we don't need them. So the first trial, as I said, didn't happen until this past summer, so many years later. By the time at that point there'd been these two rebukes at the Supreme Court, there'd really been sort of great international disapproval. I mean, if you think of Nuremberg, whatever its flaws, as being this kind of great monument to the rule of law, this great kind of emblem of the importance of the rule of law and the dispensing of justice, these military tribunals were really the opposite. I mean, they began under this great cloud of controversy, And the problem now is that that in these final months, beginning in August, President Bush has rushed to get a number of these military tribunals started, including that of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and a number of his co-conspirators, as well as a couple of guys who were captured years ago as teenagers and who've been on Guantanamo since then, Omar Khadr being one of them, a Canadian. And the ball is now rolling on these military commissions. So it's going to be a sort of a dilemma for Obama. And the question is, well, is he going to? I mean, his options are to go ahead, continue with these tribunals, which I think most people are really hoping he doesn't do, and which I think he probably won't do. But then, well, what are his alternatives? And certainly, I think he would prefer, and I know almost everyone would prefer federal trials. But now the question is, well, these men have been many of these men have been tortured. Even this, if you look at these military tribunal systems, the system which was truly set up to ensure convictions. I mean, the general counsel of the Pentagon, in a conversation with one of his lawyers, said very directly, we can't have acquittals. We're not going to have acquittals. Even this system, which was set up to ensure acquittals, to ensure convictions, the very first day of Hamdan's trial, a number of his statements were thrown out because they had been tortured. They'd been coerced from him. He is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, he was treated relatively well compared with how many detainees were treated. So is this any of this evidence going to be admissible in federal court? Is federal court going to be an option? That's one possibility. A third possibility that some have discussed is to create what people are calling national security courts, which would be a sort of a special court system within our federal courts, maybe something along the lines of a specialized bankruptcy court to handle these cases. But the problem there is again you get these questions of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're creating a special court system, you're basically creating aren't you creating that court system so that you can deny people certain rights, get away with denying them certain rights? So there's going to be a legitimacy question about if Obama goes that route as well. And then, of course, the other option is not to try these guys at all. But he can't and won't want to and shouldn't hold people indefinitely without trial, which is historically what happens during a war. You hold people until the end of hostilities and then you release them. But the hostilities and the war on terror are going to be going on for well beyond my lifetime. So what do you do? And another possibility is he could go to Congress and they ask for Congress to pass some sort of legislation that would enable him to detain enemy combatants, to not try them but to hold them, and there would presumably have to be some sort of built-in review process. So these are just a few of the different ideas, but the truth is at this point there's a lot of dialogue about what might happen, but Obama himself has aside from saying he's going to close Guantanamo has really said nothing about what he intends to do, and frankly I think he won't until A, his national security team is in place, and B, until he's been through the classified files of these 250 men who remain on Guantanamo. So that's sort of where things stand right now.
It's important to mention that the prosecutor, the chief Guantanamo prosecutor, has and not only the current but also the former one, said that the plan is to try up to 80 to 90
that's
detainees, yep, out of the 250 that you have now. And also one fact that is no less important is that around 60 detainees currently held at Guantanamo were cleared yep, for release. They don't pose any national security threat, but yet the U.S. government failed to reach some kind of a resolution regarding transferring them to a country that will take them, not their home country, because obviously for those they will have serious threat of being abused and tortured by their home country. So, for example, you heard in the news the case of the Chinese Uyghurs that were cleared to be released, and yet the government continues to try to find ways to keep them in Guantanamo and not to release them to the United States, and there's an appeal continuing in this particular case. So I want to go back just maybe in a couple of minutes so that we can open it to questions to the panel, because you mentioned the pardon, Eric, in the beginning of the possibility of a pardon. And there is a chance that President Bush, before leaving the White House, issue what they call the preemptive pardon. This is something that you cannot undo. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it right after it's issued. And the idea is to issue one that does not only name individuals that are known, like former officials that served in his administration, but even unknown officials with, you know, undercover agents, CIA agents, and so forth, that kind of a blank of pardon. How do you see the possibility of accountability in light of a pardon like this, where you don't have a criminal prosecution that could result from a commission that was suggested in the report? Do you think that there would be a chance to still, there's a value in creating such a commission with investigative powers, yet with no ability to criminalize or initiate criminal prosecution afterwards?
Let me plagiarize Patty Blum, actually, here, shamelessly. She points out in her paper, and I urge you again to pick it up, because this is going to be the first issue that we're going to have to deal with, is the possibility that there may be a general amnesty or a pardon. And first of all, if there is a pardon, it means it's going to open up universal jurisdiction, which means that other countries, just the same way they pursued Pinochet, Marcos, and others, are going to open up possible court cases overseas. So renewing your passport and traveling there if you're a senior government official dealing with the detention.
Forget about Europe.
That's right. Secondly, and to keep in mind that this, that a pardon in scope will be unprecedented. If President Bush gives a pardon, it will stretch over many topics, including domestic wiretap. It could, potentially. Domestic wiretapping, it can go to detention procedures, it can go interrogation procedures, renditions, you name it. Now, imagine the universe of how many civilian and military officials that would cover. And this would also be a disincentive for future accountability. Personally, I led forensic teams in to do exhumations in many countries. In Iraq, Iraqi Kurdistan, I took a team in, a photographer here who went with me as well, Susan Micellis. We were flown in on Black Hawk helicopters by the U.S. Army to investigate Saddam's crimes. We've sent, the Department of Justice has sent lawyers to the Yugoslavia Tribunal. Army troops have been involved in protecting forensic teams there. We have promoted accountability overseas. If we don't promote it at home, it's American exceptionalism, and it's really hypocritical. So for those of us who've been involved in working in other countries on investigations, we think it's extremely important. The other thing to understand is a pardon would be contravening international law. We have ratified in 1994 the Convention Against Torture, which specifies that if torture takes place, there should be criminal investigations. So the potential that we will be going against international law is there. And then in policymaking, imagine what this does to Obama. If he had his own path to accountability, his transition team has been working on, it could be scuttled. And imagine what the implications are for foreign policy. Because the idea of a commission, and we've seen it in other countries, is when you establish a commission, you send up a neon sign that says, we're going to look back at wrongdoing. And this will send a signal to the world of the importance of looking to all aspects. In fact, I would call what our discussion today is not Obama's dilemma, it's Obama's Gordian knot. There's so many issues here that have to be untangled and a new, you know, going back but looking forward. And if we don't deal with the issue of accountability, it's going to be a sense where the American people will not have taken control of the actions of their government. And that's what this is all about.
So it's, please, there are two microphones. We're going to take three or four questions and then give the panel a chance to answer them, and then we'll take another batch of questions. We have 25 minutes or so, which is a good time for questions. Yes, please.
Professor Stover, just to follow up with what you just said, your last comment, you read my mind, that if Guantanamo was happening in, let's say, somewhere in Zimbabwe, we would have held Mugabe responsible as a war criminal. Why aren't we getting our president now responsible for what is happening in Guantanamo or in Bagram or Abu Ghraib? Rumsfeld and Cheney and so on to follow as a war criminal. Why aren't we questioning them?
Other questions can take, if there are other. Okay, please.
Going beyond Guantanamo, but as a backdrop to it, you've mentioned the war on terror, and I just wonder whether anybody, and this goes beyond your report and your book, but whether anybody in the U.S. has seriously challenged the notion of the war of terror. I mean, you mentioned almost matter-of-factly this is a war that is going to last beyond your lifetime, and I don't feel comfortable with that concept. So I'd just like to know whether anybody addressed that in a serious matter. Thanks.
Take one more or two more? Yes, please, in the back.
With the news that came yesterday with several Guantanamo detainees saying that they would plead guilty, there seemed to be some question as to whether or not there could be a decision made about their guilt and sentencing of them if the panel of military officials were not allowed to hear the actual facts in the case. And so I wonder, you know, how will this kind of new revelation of how Guantanamo detainees might actually be taking, for lack of better understanding what they were doing, but take justice into their own hands, how will this kind of shape military tribunals or what happens to people in Guantanamo?
So the question on why... I think you'd have to direct that to the current administration. our point about a commission and the role of a commission with teeth. I mean, a commission that lets the evidence, follows the evidence, and if there is criminal liability, passes that on to a prosecutor or whatever. But we've seen in Peru, we saw it in Chile, we saw it in Argentina, where there were pardons, there were amnesties. But by establishing a commission that started gathering information about what took place, they got public policy within those countries to actually overrule those pardons and amnesties. So now you started having investigations of Pinochet when he had been amnestied by and other military officials. So the part of this is, on the one hand, you want to start building up the American public to respect, dig out more information, more directives to find out what actually took place. And this will also give you a support for criminal investigations. I'll just mention on the war on terror, In the UK now, that word is not used as it was in the past. And the lessons come from that also from Northern Ireland, that in Northern Ireland, if you called your enemy there was a war on terrorism, you actually in some ways rose to the status of a warrior. And that's not what this is in this sense. It's about the legal investigation of actual crime.
Yeah, I mean, just to pick up on the war on terror question, I mean, I certainly didn't mean to suggest that I endorse this idea that this is legitimately a war. In fact, I think that that's one of the great lessons of the Bush administration is that we can't treat the war on terror like a war, that it does not conform to our understanding of war. I mean, that's it was that very idea, that very conviction that got us into the mess we're in, that created a place where we have indefinitely detained prisoners with no access to any kind of legal recourse, or at least not until challenges were brought at the Supreme Court. So then the question is, well, where does that leave you? And I think there are, I guess, three different ways of looking at it. I think one could say that you know, there are those who will continue to argue in the vein of the Bush administration that it is a war and that it needs to be treated as a war. Though I think the people making that argument will probably decrease when we have a Democratic president, because the Republicans who are making that argument won't want to empower a Democratic commander in chief necessarily. And so then the other end of the spectrum is which I think is probably what the ACLU is arguing, which is that it needs to be treated within the context of the criminal justice system, that terrorism has to be treated as a criminal act, that these people need to be either tried in the criminal justice system or released. And then I think somewhere in the middle is the idea that that we are going to need to find a third way that kind of acknowledges that there are certain aspects of the fight against terrorism that is a war, that we're fighting in tribal areas in Afghanistan, et cetera. But that at the same time, it's not by any means a conventional war, and that we need to bring the criminal justice system to bear as much as possible. Now, if you were to ask me which one of these three avenues I think Obama is going to pursue, I think it's the latter one, and I think that it will make people on both sides unhappy. But I think he is not going to yield this notion of a military conflict altogether, because he will be giving away a lot of power to prosecute the fight against terrorism, let's call it, as he sees fits. He'll be losing a lot of flexibility. And at the same time, I don't think we're going to see the same sorts of we're certainly not going to see the same sort of abuses under the rubric of the commander in chief and this idea that he can do whatever he wants under an Obama administration. I think he's going to be much more respectful of the role that Congress needs to play in this process, because the Bush administration treated the Congress with really pure disdain, and Congress unfortunately didn't insert itself into the process either. So they basically empowered the president to do whatever he wanted. And I think that the Obama administration is also going to respect the role of the courts and not try to, as the Bush administration has done, find a loophole around every decision that sort of goes against him in the war on terror, which is really what the Bush administration has done time and time again in four of these big decisions in the war on terror. The president has found ways to circumvent them, and he's either done that with the collaboration of Congress, or he's done it simply by virtue of an executive order or a signing statement that if Congress passes a piece of legislation that doesn't say exactly what he wants it to say, as was the case when Congress passed the Military Commissions Act, legalizing military commissions, he can attach a signing statement to it saying that he actually has the right to violate this law if necessary for the interests of national security. I we're not going to see that any longer, but I also think that, or my guess, and Jimmy I think would be an interesting person to hear on this subject too. My guess is that he's also not going to return completely to the pre-9/11 paradigm of treating terrorism as a criminal act. And indeed, one has to remember that our last Democratic president, President Clinton, after the embassy bombings in 1998, launched military action against Al Qaeda, and that was very much within a military paradigm. So.
Well, Laurel, and then
sorry.
I'll try to say one quick comment about this, and then we'll move to another question.
I just wanted to comment on the question about the guilty pleas. And I think that it brings up the question of what are the camp conditions? How can we understand those guilty pleas? Now, I don't represent those defendants. I haven't spoken to them. But we did speak with others who have been in Guantanamo, and I did want to put this a little bit in perspective. So the Guantanamo is divided up into several camp systems with increasing levels of restriction. The most restrictive are Camp 5 and Camp 6, and there's a so-called Camp 7, which is operated by the CIA but not officially acknowledged. So we didn't interview anyone in Camp 5 and 6, but we know that those conditions there are more restrictive than the conditions in Camp 3 and Camp 4, which is where those who we interviewed were detained. And as Eric talked about, the cumulative effect and the mental deterioration that occurred in those detainees, and as was told to us by their lawyers, and particularly brought about by the use of solitary confinement, we can only assume is worse and more severe in those among the high-value detainees who are kept in Camp 5 and 6, which are essentially they're in isolation. They don't have any contact with other detainees. They're only let out once every 48 hours, and the way they manipulate the cycles, it turns out to be sort of once every almost 48 hours for 15 minutes of exercise. So, and we know that takes an incredible toll on the psyche of individuals. We also know from the New York Times report today that there were questions about the mental capacity of two of those defendants to represent themselves, and that shouldn't come as a surprise. So that, you know, whether or not, so how are we supposed to understand that? Obviously, that they wrote this statement on November 4th is a political message, but what each individual intended by his action to accept a guilty plea and accept, in a sense, welcome the death penalty, clearly there's a political impact there of sort of becoming martyrs to a larger cause, but I don't think that we know enough about their mental capacity of each of those individuals and what they intended. And we certainly know from those with whom we spoke about the despair brought on by an indefinite sentence in Guantanamo, that they didn't know why they were there, they didn't know how they would get out, and they didn't know what they could do to get out. And that type of despair exacted an incredible toll. So I just think that we need to understand that and its implications for the Obama administration. What it does, it throws a monkey wrench in this whole system. And that's, I think we can presume that that's what colleague Sheikh Mohammed intended to do, sort of as the spokesperson to interject this guilty plea. So now what are you going to do, Obama? Now how are you going to treat us? And I think that is, for all the reasons that have been said, that is going to remain a dilemma. But going back to what else Obama can do to address that, you can't differentiate between, so these, you know, criminal acts and how are we going to have accountability for those who've committed war crimes who are in Guantanamo, and the conditions under which the U.S. is responsible for maintaining those defendants. And what Obama could do immediately is to reinstate the Third Geneva Conventions for the treatment of those who are held in Guantanamo, take them out of isolation. The Third Geneva Convention is a code that sets forth in incredible detail the rights and conditions which prisoners of war ought to be kept under. So reinstate those, and so that you can address, so that people can have due process, that they could represent themselves should they so desire. Let's take that off of the table when we're thinking about addressing the problem.
Right, although this will create another complication, which is what the Bush administration was trying to avoid, is to give them the status of prisoners of war. And that would imply, although some other countries in the world did do the exact same thing. I can tell you from my experience working in Israel on those issues, Israel did apply some notions of the Fourth Geneva and Third Geneva Conventions with the treatment of detention operations. You go there, you see the protocol of how to handle in terms of conditions. I'm not talking about interrogation techniques, that's a separate question. But just back quickly to Jonathan's point, it tempted me to answer you, is that I think that the people who are suggesting creating a new system, National Security Court, like a bankruptcy court or whatever, I think they are not telling the entire story about our federal court system, which has been tested. Including after 9/11, there are over 100 cases of terrorism cases that were prosecuted, not in the magnitude of 9/11 attacks, although Zakaria Moussaoui was associated with the 9/11 attacks, and he was prosecuted and tried and convicted in Virginia court. The other point is, pre-9/11, courts did handle those cases. In fact, two attacks that happened, one in 1994, the first attack on World War Trade Center, and the 1998 East Africa bombings, there were defendants that were prosecuted, and some of them were captured and brought to justice in the same courts. And you mentioned the military attack that the government launched on Sudan right after 1998 East Africa bombing. It was interesting, in a lot of those cases, when you go to read the charge sheet of the military commission indictments, the government goes back to 1996 in saying these people started to conspire since 1996.
The first fatwa, I guess.
Exactly. And then one of the individuals who is now facing charges before the military commissions was, and still, I think, legally speaking, a co-defendant in the Southern District of New York in the 1998 indictment under the Clinton administration. The prosecutor, after 9/11, the Attorney General Ashcroft ordered to pass this file from the Southern District of New York to D.C. because they are handling all these cases. The same individual who was fugitive, who was at large, El-Ghaliani, was captured and was brought to Guantanamo by the CIA. Now he's facing military commission trial. He could have easily, based on the evidence that existed against most of those people, and there were people who were charged and sentenced to life in the U.S. Last point I want to mention about the issues of pardons and the work. You know, the fact that accountability, lack of accountability might lead to really dangerous effect worldwide. The U.S. for the first time brought charges against the son of Charles Taylor, Chucky Taylor, in U.S. courts in Florida based on the torture statute that was enacted after the adoption and ratification by the U.S. of the Convention Against Torture. And he was accused of conspiring to commit torture, actually establishing this anti-terrorism unit in Liberia. And then what happened is that his defense lawyers used the same exact memos that the Bush administration have issued in order to redefine the definition of torture and say that this particular defendant has not committed torture under the same definition of the Bush administration. So you can see, you don't have to wait until cases arise overseas. It's happening right here. And he was convicted. He's waiting his sentencing. And we're studying this case to see really the full implication of this case. Why don't we take more questions? We have about maybe 6 minutes or so before we wrap up. Yes.
I just want to thank you for the roundtable. It's been interesting. And the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers has taken the position that a court's martial should be used in place of the military commissions. I just kind of wanted to see how you felt about that.
Hi, my question's one about accountability also. And just to play devil's advocate a little bit to deepen the discussion a bit, we're hearing from inside the Obama team a lack of an appetite, you know, to really pursue a strong accountability agenda. And I think that's coming from the massive economic crisis we have, you know, the kind of the need to kind of get beyond the Bush abuses and think forward and restore the country and all that. And so the question is, what's the answer to that kind of sentiment, number one? And number two, what more specifically could be done to build political will for an accountability agenda, especially given everything else that the country is facing now?
Take one more question before we... Yes, sir.
I was going to say, there's a lot of attention on, obviously, rule of law issues, detention issues, and accountability issues. But from the front end, there's obviously a serious problem in terms of information gathering and corroboration at the battlefield, sort of ground level. Professor Stover, you mentioned about the issue of bounties, but there's also issues about translation problems or issues about not understanding culture, things like that. And I'm curious if any of you, ACLU, Open Society, whomever, is having discussions about thinking about what policy changes, sort of on the ground war policy changes the Obama administration should be making in order to really correct the front end of a lot of this problem, in addition to sort of the middle and the back end being accountability.
Well, I would say that's a very good question, and it's a very good point, and I don't know anything about any efforts toward that end, but it would be interesting to explore. In terms of the question about accountability and the sort of notion and the noise that that the Obama administration is likely not to do anything sort of aggressive, and I think that that's right. I think that is the sense we're getting, and Obama has, you know, before the election, really, or before the election sort of came out and said that. But I would say, I mean, I would go back to this question of Congress. I mean, that you know, this is something that Congress needs to take on. That is what Congress is for, to check the executive branch, to oversee the executive branch. All of this happened on Congress's watch and should not have been allowed to happen on Congress's Congress's watch, and we now have it. And you know, the Democrats blamed it on the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Well, we now have a Democratic Congress, and it's your job to do something along the lines of the Church Committee, which you know investigated all of the abuses of the sort of the Watergate Vietnam era, mm-hmm. and I mean conducted hundreds and hundreds of interviews, issued hundreds of subpoenas. I mean that's I think the responsibility is Congress's, to be honest. In terms of the court's martial question, I think that's also something that Jamil can probably speak to as a lawyer. But I mean, my sense is that it certainly is a preferable alternative to the military commissions. That you know, the United States does have a courts martial system that's built to try war crimes cases, that's built to take into account issues of national security, et cetera, and it's, you know, it's certainly something that the military lawyers are very proud of, and so I think, yeah, I do think it's certainly a preferable alternative to these sort of tainted military commissions.
I'll just address the third one about on the ground. Stephen Abram, who was in the U.S. Army Reserve, and he was in these commissions and that were established. He was supposed to put all the data together that was being collected by the interrogation, and he resigned. And he made the point that, you know, humane treatment of inhumane people is not foreign to the U.S. military, and we need to keep that in mind. Keep that thought. Antonio Taguba. Antonio Taguba was the two-star general who led the investigation to Abu Ghraib. And what General Taguba has said, and he was eventually forced out of office because of that investigation and what he found. But he said, look, you can't ask us in Iraq to have two standards of interrogation. One, which is under the U.S. Army Field Manual, which goes by basically the golden rule. Now, of course, we know this, you know, can be violated. And the golden rule is effectively that no U.S. soldier would do anything to an enemy that they would want done to an American civilian or American military personnel. What happened was in Iraq, and what so bothered Taguba, was that you had the CIA coming in with its interrogation procedures, and you had the military supposedly operating under theirs. And he says, you can't have that. We have to have a system. And this is something that President Obama could do, is to declare that we will have one interrogation system that is lawful and that it will be followed by all U.S. agencies. And also, beyond reinstating the Geneva Conventions will go a long way, but let's repeal the Military Commissions Act as well and develop within the rank and file that those commanders who don't discipline their forces, because the Geneva Conventions are only really enforced on the ground in real time by commanders. And that's what we saw at Bagram. One of the guards at Bagram said, hey, I had my U.S. manual here. I had the Geneva Conventions. I was working 18-hour days. You think I ever opened them? I didn't need to, because I was actually being asked, you know, how are you doing? I was encouraged. I was never told to stop the abuses that were going on. And so you need to have, one area to work on would be to a better discipline of commanders at that level of command.
I just wanted to address Anne's question about political will, and I don't know that I have a completely satisfactory answer, but I do think in the absence of, it's too early to declare victory for the Obama administration, and that this is exactly the role of civil society to push for accountability and to make the case for why it is not sufficient to simply close the facility. And I think that keeping up that, as many op-eds, I think what's really needed is, to bring out those credible voices from within the military who could say, we need this for ourselves. We need to disincentivize illegal activities. We need to be able to stand for the rule of law once again, and we cannot stand for the rule of law if we pretend that the last
six to eight years didn't happen. And we need to this for ourselves. And we need this to be able to restore U.S. prestige and to really get behind that as a political agenda, I think is what's gonna need to happen and where that leadership comes from, right? Obama is not signaling that himself. That doesn't, to me, suggest that he wouldn't support that. It's just that's not what he's going to lead on. So who are the people who can lead on that? Who are those respected voices that can be joined by civil society, can be joined by human rights organizations and advocate that? I mean, I think that's kind of this critical gap that is a void at this point that ought to be filled. And I think that would, that could go a long way. That could tip the balance and say, wait a minute, this is a legitimate, legitimate endeavor and one that actually will benefit and improve U.S. stature and standing, won't be decreasing or diminishing it.
I'm afraid we have to close. I just want to say that, we have to deal with some kind of expectation management after Obama takes office, because there's a lot of expectation. But I agree with you. We have to remain watchdogs and to monitor what's happening. At least we are promised that he will be more transparent and there will be some more accountability. This last weekend, I was in Iowa. I mentioned this former congressman, Republican Leach, was there to get an award, and he was sent by the Obama administration to meet the G20 leaders in the meeting. And one thing that he kept hearing from those leaders, when we wish that this transition process is shorter. We can't wait until that transition is over. So I think it's really a sentiment that people around the world and certainly in this country is looking forward for a new era, and we hope that things will be better and we will continue to debate and discuss those issues. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for the panel. Thank you.